This is Product by Design, a podcast by Prodigy, where we explore technology, artificial intelligence, user experience, product management, and the philosophy of building products and companies. All right, welcome to another episode of Product by Design. I am Kyle Evans, and this week we've got another awesome guest with us, Virag Garabjanian. Virag, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kyle, for having me. Great to be here.
Excited to have you. I'm excited to talk more about your background and some of your experience, but let me introduce you briefly, and then you can tell us a little bit more about yourself. Virag is a founding partner of Actuate, which is a boutique advisory firm that helps innovative companies accelerate revenue through strategy, business development, and disruptive technology partnerships. So a lot to talk about there in that description, but why don't you tell us more about yourself and what you do?
Sure thing. So, you know, my story starts with the fact that I grew up in an Armenian family in Southern California. Was always expected to be a doctor or a lawyer, but I was a little bit more rebellious. You know, I was good at math and physics, so I went into engineering and undergrad. But, you know, my second year of college at UCI, unfortunately, some tragedy started to happen. I lost about six people in my family in a few years, and I still bring that up to this day. Because it forced me to, you know, ask the age-old question of, you know, what is it you want to do with your life? And, you know, fast forward a year of like soul searching and digging. This is back in like 2008, 2009. Technology kept coming up. It wasn't as obvious as it is today, but the idea, especially of computing platforms at that time, smartphones taking off and what the future version of that could be was what really excited me. I got really lucky that my you know, first real experience in tech was at the world's largest, you know, private infrastructure company, wireless infrastructure company called Mobility. CEO there trusted me with, you know, with a good amount of money to basically build the technology from scratch. We were trying to make mobile devices communicate with each other back in the 3G days in a more ad hoc kind of mesh networking decentralized way. And that helped like relieve some of the congestion on some of those networks. So it was that first, you know, aha moment where I thought, you know, this intersection of technology and business is really where I want to be for the rest of my career. Graduate from UCI, wanted to get, you know, a more formal education in that intersection. So I thought MIT would be a great place to do that. Packed the bag, moved to the East Coast, just started shaking hands, and eventually ended up at a boutique consulting firm called Endeavor Partners. That was kind of a think tank of MIT, Harvard people that were helping mobile device manufacturers and wireless carriers with strategy and some IP work as well too. And so, you know, I had to prove myself there. Did a lot of research at first, but then it started becoming more client facing, managing larger projects. And it was answering those questions of how do you grow the company through better product portfolios, better business strategies, and better technologies that align more with the goals of the business. So did that for a few years, was lucky enough to go to MIT across the street, did a lot of great things there for a couple of years. But I got really deep into the AR VR space in the summer of 2016. And I got to try every demo available at Silicon Valley, representing Applied Materials at that time. So a huge semiconductor company. And I felt like I was looking into the future, the next computing platform. And I knew that's what I wanted to work on going forward. So graduate, come back to Los Angeles and join this very early stage AI computer vision startup. And they were doing all the perception technologies for helping devices understand their environments and their users. And we were dialing into the, you know, AR VR space. And my role there was to figure out, you know, the go-to-market strategy, and you know, tie that back to how the product would be shaped from the amazing AI that we had, and then eventually, you know, hiring a team around that, and we landed some amazing, you know, deals with the larger companies like Qualcomm, Lenovo, and after, you know, a few years of that, we were getting enough of that kind of escape velocity where Qualcomm wanted to roll us into bigger plans, and we sold the company, which was great. I already had, you know, was doing some great consulting with larger companies and startups. And so that's what Actuate was. It was born out of that friction of, you know, technology partnerships, and helping especially smaller startups as well with go to market and, how that would relate to their products, all of that. And so that's what I've been doing. I'm in LA and, joining you here from Pasadena. That's the background behind me here now. So that's a little bit about me. Happy to, you know, zoom in wherever you'd like, but, it's great to be on the show.
Awesome. Well, we definitely want to zoom in on a couple of those areas, but before we do that, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the things that you like to do outside of work or outside of the office?
Oh, nice. Great question. So I do outside. So I'm, you know, pretty like family and friend oriented, love being around people. So spend a lot of my time with, you know, the family. I've got, you know, a nephew and niece, and then a nephew on my wife's side. So there's a lot of, you know, family time. Sports, love playing golf and tennis, grew up playing basketball, but I'm getting too old for that now. Snowboarding when the season's right. And then like, you know, try to do a lot of reading, right? Like research on the trends in the industry, business principles. And then if I've got time, you know, looking at the stock market and looking at where the opportunities are there as kind of a, as an investor as well too. So.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of great stuff.
Yeah.
So I do want to zoom in, like you said, on a number of different things that you talked about. And you mentioned, you know, earlier in your career, you know, being involved in some of the product management, some of the management and strategy, both on, you know, some of the hardware and software side, you know, being involved in, you know, some of the development of these technologies. Tell us a little bit more about that experience. Like, you know, what was it like in helping to craft some of these things, especially earlier in the days of AR and VR, and as this XR experience is starting to be shaped and taking shape ultimately?
Yeah, taking you back to like 2017, we had realized that like the XR space was probably the best for the companies that core technological capabilities, which at that time were the ability to track hands and gestures, believe it or not. So just with cameras. And funny enough, like that was a little bit too early because the devices that we were dealing with at that time barely even had cameras on them. If they did, they were very basic. And so that's where it's an example of where, you know, hardware meets software and you need certain hardware to enable software. It's pretty deep in the tech stack, right? So in that, I think the exercise there in product management in those early days is really staying in touch with the key decision makers and stakeholders in the industry who are going to determine what that hardware is going to look like, right? And that was part of our value prop. There were other players who were literally building the hardware as well. That's an option, but it has, of course, like business trade-offs. And our value prop was we're really focused on the software, and we'll pair with, you know, the ecosystem's choice of hardware, right? But we had to do our job and to make our software relevant. We had to be very much in touch with, you know, all the big players that were going to define that roadmap. Qualcomm is and has been and continues to be the largest stakeholder, I think, with the largest share. And so we were very much in touch with them. So it was an exercise of like understanding what is your roadmap? What are all the other OEMs going to be doing in this space? What kind of cameras are they going to be onboarding in the next 12 months, in the next 24 and 36 months? And then educating them on, well, what are our capabilities? What does our roadmap look like? And trying to like align that as much as possible. You know, that did lead to eventually like a win, because at some point, you know, we were kind of setting up the software to be pretty hardware agnostic, right? Meaning should it be, you know, this kind of, you know, RGB camera, or if it's going to be a depth sensor, we could, you know, handle those two and others. But at that time we realized that, you know, we were part of a larger kind of stack of other technologies. It's not as if just hand tracking is important, right? There's other feature sets. And so there was a set of cameras that were emerging at that time until like 2018, 19, where one other capability that came even before hand tracking was being able to track environments, just knowing where the headset is in three-dimensional space. Those were enabled by two very basic black and white cameras. You know, they call them monochrome cameras, whatever. It means the same thing, and cheaper, smaller, and set in a way to do that functionality really well. At first, it seemed like that was very hard to do hand tracking with, but eventually when training of data sets started getting better, right, and more advanced, we started iterating on that more and more, and then realizing like, oh wow, these are aligning really well. Like, we can get more and more performance if we keep investing in this. Of course, through, again, this is where BD and PM are very closely related. Through a lot of biz dev and influence, you're able to kind of tune those cameras a little bit for what you might need out of your software to make it more performant. And we were successful in doing that pretty well. And I think that's where like the rubber meets the road of good biz dev while you're building out technology. And then within that, you know, eventually a good product with a good offering. Right. So I think that answers your question, but I can zoom in more where needed.
Yeah, no, you brought up a couple of things that really come to mind, like as I think through a lot of this and some of the experience that I've had in similar cases. I'm interested, just, you know, zooming out a little bit on the relationship that you've had with, you know, developing products and then the biz dev, like you were talking about. So as we're working with, you know, business development and as we're building products, you know, with the, you know, product management and whether that's hardware and software or potentially just software, like what are some of the things that you found that really make that work, from both your experience and then maybe some of the things that you've seen that, you know, hey, these are the things that worked and that, you know, the principles that make this work going forward so that, you know, you're not either fighting against each other or you don't have like, you know, one group working in one way and another group working in another way. You're really working in tandem to make this thing happen.
Yeah, it's a good question because it points at what could be like a lot of important tension, right? Again, in an organization. And let me like maybe describe that tension a little bit and what I did to sort of help. So there might be when you're in early stages of a company, there might be a opportunity with a larger company or what might be a kind of bigger deal. And that's really great for the company commercially to like, you know, jump into that and get your first customer. That's a really hard thing to get, by the way, your first customer. That's a separate podcast. But like, but that customer may want you to do things that are in scope, some of which might be out of scope, right? And so as a biz dev person, you may really want to lean into that and push the company in that way. And there's benefits in doing that, right? You get your first customer, you learn from there, you drive revenue. But at the same time, I think it's important to, before you leap in too far, you want to know like, well, what do other customers want, right? And this is where like really solid customer discovery comes in, and hopefully you have enough money raised or the bandwidth and the time to go out and do that before you jump in with 2 feet to just one customer where you take on too much risk, right? At the same time, the other, you know, side of the pond and even in a small company is a CTO or a product person who's, you know, trying to advance the technology with what drives them. It could be like new cutting edge research. It could be, you know, wanting to build for the sake of building, which when you're a builder, that's what drives you and motivates you. And then you might start building things that are not aligned with what customer needs are at that given point in time, right? And it's in that intersection where if you can land on an intersection where real actual progress happens in finding product market fit eventually, right? I actually think that this is... It's a normal tension. That's the first thing to note. But there aren't any good tools actually out there yet, I think, that do a good job with this. It's still an exercise that sits in spreadsheet form. And that's what I did, right? Which was, let's go find those first 10 customers that make sense with business goals. We know we want to go after this industry because that's where there's, you know, there's growth. That's where there's a willingness to pay. There's a need for this kind of technology. That exercise, which is more go-to-market strategy, is done. Let's get the 10 customers that make the most sense and have conversations with them just in discovery on what their needs are. From there, let's back that down to like, okay, what are the technologies that enable those needs? And then looking at a cross-section of those 10, like which are the most common, right? One of them might be paying a lot more, but if it has two or three, you know, features or technological capabilities or attributes that like aren't aligning with the others, you have to, as the biz dev person in early stage, you have to know, or the CEO, that could be the CEO's job. You need to know you need to be real about that. Right. And then put that in spreadsheet form and communicate that with your product people or with your technology team. And identify it like, okay, you know what, this is what we have now, but these two or three things keep coming up across 7 out of 10. That should be part of the roadmap. And then of course it's more of a PM exercise from there in terms of, okay, well, which one of these do we tackle first? What's like a first step towards having that capability, and then prioritizing, you know, by effort and all that, right? But sad to say, it is a lot of conversation, and then as simple as spreadsheets. You know, I mean, there could be a tool that emerges that's better than that to be a little more analytical or a little more visual about that. But that's what we did at our time.
Yeah. No, that definitely resonates both with me and I'm sure with a lot of people listening. I do want to talk some more about some of the things that you mentioned, but as we get there, you know, why don't you tell us a little bit more about, you know, present day Actuate? What is it that kind of led you? You mentioned, you know, some of the things that kind of led you to that. You know, what was it that led to Actuate, and what is it that you kind of focus on with what you're doing right now?
The first impetus for Actuate was the friction behind technology partnerships, with more and more companies doing more interesting things in a more distributed way and all over the world. It becomes more important to basically like find the needs of some companies. It could be large ones or ones that have, you know, some product market fit, and then figure out what are the gaps between what they're trying to do internally and for their customers. And then find the right technologies that make that better, right? Whether it's a product offering or whether it's an internal operation. And there's just so many options out there of companies that can do amazing things. Like, how do you, you know, go about defining the requirements? And by the way, if it is for a large company, then like it's not one person's requirements. It could be 8 people or more. And there isn't really like a structured way of doing that. A lot of organizations might have a team that's supposed to do that. And they may have a more structured approach, but more often than not, even if they do, it's a little hand wavy in nature. And I've been somewhat of a victim of that. I've seen them be a victim of not being structured around that. So that's the original impetus behind Actuate. It was like technology partnership as a service. Once I started doing that more and more, I realized, well, there's more and more needs out there. On the startup side, there are many who still face the challenge, especially if they're more technical, of like having a proper go-to-market, figuring out how to land a customer deal, especially if it's a higher ticket one. They may not have had those experiences. So helping them with that, and then believe it or not, like, you know, fundraising just comes up more and more, right? Like, because those things are closely tied, especially on the go-to-market. I specialize a little bit more on quote unquote deep tech, which it's kind of a vague term, but really what it means is like technologies that aren't just a simple mobile app or a simple web app, right? It requires a technological differentiation or innovation that enables the product's capabilities. And people who can build those are often the same people who don't have as much experience on the business side. So that, you know, is a good alignment with me, because although I'm not the world's best programmer or engineer, I can get in the room pretty quickly and kind of understand the capabilities or limitations or what they're trying to do, and then get to the business side very quickly from there. So Right now, it's services for startups on especially B2B deep tech ones that are go-to-market and fundraising and some biz dev coaching. And then for the larger companies or mid-cap companies, it is technology partnerships. Sometimes it's just building a point of view on, hey, what can we do with AI in our business, right? And that's coming up more and more, obviously. So it's, you know, it's consulting projects around that. And then more recently, there's been more and more requests around like deployment of some of these technologies, right? And so that's something, especially around XR and AI, where I specialize a little bit more, that's coming up more and more.
I think that's really interesting. And I'm interested in, mm-hmm. you know, some of the, first off, some of the go-to-market, like what are some of the issues or difficulties that you see in, you know, companies or people that you're working with that they have in, you know, some of that go-to-market, whether that's initial go-to-market or subsequent go-to-market with the things that they're working on?
So the worst I've seen is companies who just say, hey, we're going after this market and this is the size of that market based on this report. It's going to be a $20 billion market in the next 3 to 5 years. And we're going after that market. Okay. That is not nearly specific enough. Right. And so, not being able to answer the question of within that market, what, like get more specific, like what segment, right. Within that market. So what location, but we're talking about a customer target here, especially if it's B2B, like, are we talking about just North America? Are we talking about Europe? What company sizes are we talking about? Is it like small cap, mid cap, large cap, right? These all have different implications on what channel you reach them through. And then, getting down to like the psychographic of like, who's actually going to buy this. Right. And that is totally missing. And oftentimes it's not really like a staged approach that makes any sense. It's like, hey, phase one, we're going to start here. Once we tackle that market, then we can move to this second market or an adjacent market. And it makes sense to do that because now we've, you know, kind of proven ourselves here, or we have access, you know, to this set of customers where it's easy to reach that second stage, right? Something that's like logical. And especially what's missing is, even if you are that concrete, it's like, why this one first? And why would that be easier? or how would you reach them? Or do they have the willingness to pay, right? Those kinds of questions are just unanswered. They're just left way too simplistic. And then oftentimes you'll see folks that without having any of that defined, they're already defining a channel of how they're going to reach them. It's like, well, I know your channel makes no sense if you're not being specific about the segment yet, right? So, you know, even within the channel, the specifics of how you're going to do that matter, right? If we're going to go after, we've defined now, mid-cap healthcare companies that are in the United States. Okay. That's quite specific, right? Hospitals, especially, let's say. All right. Our founder happens to be a physician who's worked or rotated at all these different hospitals. That helps. That makes sense, right? That gets more clarity and more, that's a, not the best example, but you know what I'm getting at, right? That is a much better convincing go-to-market than some of the stuff I see today.
Well, why do you think it is that you know, some companies struggle with that part of their go-to-market strategy?
Okay, I'm taking a second here because I want to be careful of how I say that. I tend to get exposed to more technology-driven companies, founders that or early teams that are holding on to some differentiated new innovative technology that no one else has. If you have the capabilities to actually build that, that could take a lifetime to be that good, a whole career focused on doing that. So, you know, you're not going to put the time into reading the books or listening to the people who are talking about go-to-market. And you could be a little bit naive about what it takes to actually land a first customer because maybe you haven't done that before. On top of that, we went through, you know, like a 10-year bull cycle here of money flowing pretty more freely than it is now. And so you found a lot of people who were able to raise money without having that question answered well, right? And so, and maybe even like outsourcing that to the first biz dev person they may find, but they haven't really done the upfront analysis. So they hire the wrong person, you know, it turns into a mess. So it's kind of a confluence of factors that I think came together that made that more and more of a problem. I'm trying to think if there's any other reasons. Those are probably the primary ones that come to mind right now, you know?
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I guess from your perspective, like as you're working with, you know, a number of different companies or clients in helping craft this, like what is your approach in helping them like actually craft a better go-to-market strategy?
Sure. Yeah. And before I answer that, I want to add one more reason as to why I think it's been a challenge. I do notice there's some startups that get started out of a team of people that may have come out of a larger organization. Let's say it's 10 people from name X Fortune 100 company, and they were working on some tech, they spun it out, and they got a ton of funding. When you're at a large organization, people don't realize that a lot of times people will buy your technology or entertain using it because it comes from that brand. And if you haven't had a lot of startup experience before, you will be humbled when you get to the table, when you realize that, like, when you don't have that brand behind you, you don't have the same perception anymore. And it really becomes a lot more of a biz dev exercise. And a lot of people just kind of discount that because it's already been done for them at other companies. So they don't really know what it takes. And at a big company, you can be a little bit more vague and just enter, and that brand will take you quite far. And you just don't have that when you're starting out. To answer your question about how to help, I like to be a little bit more analytical about it. I think from the different books and stuff I've read about different people who have tackled this, like there's many different frameworks. I like to look at four or five different things while trying to prioritize markets, right? I look at which market is biggest, which one's growing fastest, which one has a willingness to pay, which one do you have good access to, which one actually really needs what you have, or has a, another way of framing that in the Y Combinator terms, like has a recurring urgent problem that your technology uniquely solves. Just starting with that, if you can do that and then do a simple exercise of brainstorming around, hey, here's the five markets we're thinking about, and kind of just filtering, scoring, and then filtering and ranking across those, you have a strong hypothesis, but that's all you have at that point. That doesn't mean you jump in with everybody into that. You might maybe for 3 to 6 months, but you want to define success and then go out and, you know, define the channel and then go out and try to do it, test it, right? And then see what you learn, see if you hit that metric you were looking for. And if you didn't, was the metric too high? Was it, it was just fine, but you came up short and you're wrong on one of the assumptions you made across those, the criteria I mentioned, then take the next one and with your learnings and try again, right? So that's how I tend to set it up.
Yeah. I think that having a go-to-market, like an actual go-to-market strategy is so important, and actually taking the time to do it is something that it, I think, too often is an afterthought in a lot of product development and a lot of the things that we're doing, just because you kind of, like you were saying, like you can have a really good idea, or you can have a really strong brand or a really good company. And like the idea of the product will sell itself, or like we've got this thing and, you know, people will just buy it. And it's just not the case. Like you have to be able to understand who it is specifically that is going to need this thing. It's not just a matter of like creating a really great thing and, you know, somebody out there is going to buy it. You have to be able to create it very specifically for, you know, somebody, like you were saying, like the physician who has rotated across these hospitals, who has, you know, this need. And we know very specifically who we're going to be targeting. Otherwise, like you're trying to sell to a $20 billion industry and you get lost in all of that. And so like have a really good understanding of what you're trying to do and why you're trying to do it is so important, because like you said too, there's not infinite amount of money flowing right now. And so like, you don't have an infinite runway anymore, like in the past. So these things are even more important than they were, a year or two ago when runways were longer and cash was abundant. Like it's much more important to dial in very, very specifically on a lot of these things, because you don't have, at least in my experience, you don't have the amount of time and bandwidth to make as many mistakes. Like obviously, you can still experiment, but like the cycle has to be much tighter and much more focused than it has in the past.
It's true.
I'm interested in how that kind of jibes with what you're seeing.
I'm in 100% alignment there. It's harder than ever, and you have less cycles to try. I think the best case would be like you had just as many cycles and you were being prudent about it. And, but I think we were in a place just a couple of years ago where, you could kind of keep pushing without getting much in return, and that could have been okay. And it was hard to differentiate, the signal from the noise there on like how interested people were, and what you're doing. So now it's a lot more concrete, right? People really want to buy things that are going to solve their problems, right? So you got to do, more with less and test more quickly and put guardrails in place. So like, you're not going too far down a path, right? That isn't the right one. And then like be able to pivot fast. Right. So it's harder for sure. It's harder.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm interested, what are some other, potential blind spots or potential areas that you're seeing as you work with companies and clients that, maybe aren't as, again, kind of like the go-to-market strategy, maybe aren't as dialed in as they ought to be, or as you would expect or hope that they would be as they're, developing new products or new new services or new features?
I'm trying to think of one that's a little bit more product related here for the audience, but what I do see often, as well as this is a little bit more business focused, but like a proper like sales funnel, right? Even as you're doing discovery, sometimes the best discovery is just going for the sale, right? You can have a lot of conversations with people about like, is this a problem? Is it not? Can you rank it? Can you do, that proper customer discovery? But sometimes you don't really know until you put an offer in front of them and you push for the sale and see if it's something they're willing to put money towards. And then even as part of the testing, being very clear with customers on when they're going to get to experience the value of your product, what steps they have to go through. And this is, again, in more of the context of like a B2B motion. If the customer doesn't know what to do next or isn't clear on how long it's going to take for them to see the value of what you can provide, how much they're going to pay for it, and what steps they need to move through with you to get there, I've used the analogy of it's like getting in a car with someone you don't know and then like not knowing what the destination is and how long it's going to take to get there and how much traffic there is along the way. Like, who would want to get in that car? Like, not many people. So I think too many early stage companies, they just kind of assume that the customer might want to drive that. It's like, no, that's on you. That's on you. Right. And again, that comes from some of those preconceived notions of like, I was at a big company and it just like everyone wanted to work with us. And that could be one reason, or they're not as business oriented. You have to really telegraph that, right? So you have to, the little bit of theory of mind stuff, right? Where put yourself in the customer's position, even better if you might have the same problem that you're trying to solve for them, and use your product or like go through the funnel the way you're doing it now. Would you buy it? Would you be proud about it? Would you be excited? And audit that really well. Like, I'm a fan of having three steps always, or like the number three is a magic number in sales and beyond. And like, what are the three steps? Tell them that and telegraph it for them, so they sort of know what they're getting into. That's a blind spot I see oftentimes, right? It's a lot of customer discovery or leads that are just kind of, you know, we don't know what the next step is, and the customer doesn't either. That's never good.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree. And you've touched on, I think, a really interesting point of the being able to bridge that, you know, product market fit of you being able to show that there is not just the value there that, you know, the customer can see and is apparent, like it's not hidden, but so much so that they're willing to pay for it. You know, you're kind of like you were saying, you get out there and are able to actually sell a product. And if you're not able to do that, if a customer is not willing to actually pay for a product, then you haven't achieved that product market fit yet, where you have solved something in a way that is valuable enough, or at least they can't see the value yet in a way that they're willing to pay for it. And so that's something kind of like you're saying, that you can actually get out and test. You can, by not being afraid to get out there and sell a product, you can experiment and see if the value is there, if people understand the value that you're providing, or if they don't. And if they don't, why don't they see the value? Like, is it not there in the product, or is it just, you know, so far away from where they are or where they can access it that you need to make some sort of adjustment? I'm interested in exploring that a little bit. Like, how can customers or how can we, and especially, you know, some of the people you're working with, how can we stay close enough to customers to actually get some of this feedback? Like, how, when you're working with them, like, what are some of the things that you do in order to do that and get that feedback?
I think willingness to pay is an important one. I think too often we think the product needs to be like very, very polished before we can put it in front of a customer. And that there needs to be a certain amount of polish to it so that it's not so ugly that everyone's so confused how to use it, right? But sometimes that is a good test. Like, hey, this is something that doesn't look very great, but it's so targeted to a problem that I have that I'm willing to go through that mess to try it, right? That could also be a solid test at some point. It's like, hey, the product's kind of full of some friction, but it is trying to get at something that it's already doing something better than how I do it now, right? I encourage some of the clients that I work with to get it out there, you know, earlier. But I think it's not wise to get it out there too far, too quickly, because sometimes you only have, you know, one shot on the larger stage and you want to be ready for that. And so I'm a believer in like the kind of private beta approach of, hey, let's get the first 10. Let's just get 10 people to love this, right? That are in the same segment, hopefully. And they get to try this, give feedback. I also don't think it's wise just to give it away for free to start. Be like, maybe a little bit for free, but to get the full cycle through your MVP even, would you pay or would you not pay? And that is very telling. Like, if they won't pay anything, and that's already a sign. Right? Like the way you're communicating your product, if it is something that is really solving a reoccurring urgent problem, then they should be willing to pay even when it doesn't seem like it's polished yet. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's definitely something that we've talked about a number of times.
Yeah. Okay.
Is the pricing strategy, and
sure,
it's definitely, I think we and a number of people are in agreement that the freemium model is it's okay in a very, very slim number of cases. And generally speaking, like people, you should be asking customers to pay because you should be providing value that is, that people are willing to pay. And there's only like some very, very small number of cases where giving it away for free makes sense. And that typically is like in a very, in much more of like a network effect type model, which
potentially
is most in generally not in most cases of the products that we're building. It's much more that, you know, you should be, pricing your product appropriately and not giving it away, kind of like you were saying.
I would add to that as well that I've seen situations where early stage companies are so technology or product driven that way too much early they are releasing that product to people, just sending it out there, and don't have a way to even track why these people might be bouncing, what they think of it. It's like, you just gave this to your first 100 customers. You threw them a link. They came on, they tried it. You don't know how long they stayed or why they bounced. I think it's probably more wise to control that a little bit more. Be on a video call with them while they're going through it and see what they do, or even be next to them in person while they're doing it, so that you can really see what's going on, like get a way better learning signal, basically.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely. I'm interested. You kind of talked about some of the deeper technologies and some of the things mm-hmm. that you have experience in, as far as, you know, AR, VR, XR, and even AI now. You know, where do you see these technologies currently, and you know, where do you see them going into the future?
XR is in a interesting inflection point. There are more than a few ways to track, you know, technology diffusions, new computing platforms. I'm a little bit more academic from my background on how I look at that. I've done some research on this before. There is a concept called dominant design. It's a word coined by a technology researcher named James Utterback. The idea of a dominant design is that when there's a new kind of technology, you can take this back to like printers, you know, or fax machines and more modern day smartphones and all that. There is a moment where there's a lot of almost, I think he describes it as a kind of a Cambrian explosion of a lot of different forms of, let's say, a given device, a technological device. And they all have different functions they're trying to tackle. So let me ground that a little bit with cell phones. For like, if you imagine the years, like the late 90s to like 2007, how many different types of phones were there in different forms for different functions, right? There was like candy bar. There were other feature phones. There were these like, you know, flip devices. One was a little bit more gaming oriented. The other a little bit more, say, just for calls and text, right? And then we have this iPhone moment where Apple figures out not necessarily brand new technology, but they figure out, you know, this interaction mechanism, right? Of pinch to zoom, multi-touch. And all of a sudden, everyone switches and starts adopting that design, right? And that is the concept of a dominant design. There's a change. And going from that explosive kind of phase to one that is more, hey, we now figured out how users interact with this. And it's more about process. It's more about, you know, manufacturing capability. It's a different skill set now. If you're a competitor to that device, you can now kind of piggyback off that design and innovate on maybe on more on the supply chain. And you see that now, like, you know, an iPhone is not too different physically from a Samsung, you know, Galaxy device, for example. So what does that mean? That's a long setup for where are we with XR, right? So XR is kind of a term for extended reality. It includes AR and VR, especially I focus a little bit more headset driven, right? And I think on the VR side of that, we're a little bit more mature where we have somewhat of a dominant design. I give some of that credit to Meta and their ability to build the Quest. And, you know, there is now a standard set of features and a form factor that everyone kind of understands now. And there's a dominant base of users of, call it, you know, 10 million users, something like that, right? That use this pretty regularly, mostly for gaming. There's enterprise uses and stuff, but we've kind of hit a dominant design there, in my opinion, where now, especially with, you know, the Vision Pro coming in, that is an interesting inflection point that is kind of bridging AR and VR. And so we're almost at that moment where you can almost think of it as like the smartwatch era, where like there was a lot of other smartwatches before the Apple Watch, but then the Apple Watch comes out and now it's like the most or the best selling, you know, smartwatch there is, right? So I think we're on that cusp. On the AR side, especially a lot of AR glasses, we're not as mature there. It's more exciting, but it's also a harder problem, especially with displays and battery. There's just a lot more technological challenges. But the Vision Pro is interesting because it is a nice blend of these, right? But it's still not the same full-blown vision of mixed reality or augmented reality glasses that are always on the go and replacing your smartphone, right? I think that's not there yet. So we're probably 6 to 7 years away where we've got something that you can start to replace maybe your laptop with or your smartphone with, right? Definitely between now and then you've got, you know, kind of a more of a paired situation, right? But probably 6, 7 years away from something that's a little bit more replacing your smartphone and on the go everywhere, always. To switch over to AI a little bit, I think there's all these different forms of AI. Obviously, generative AI is where all the focus is now. I don't see that as a new computing platform. Many people think this is now, you know, the next thing beyond the smartphone. I don't see it like that. I see it as almost a little bit more of infrastructure, almost like blockchain was in a way. It is almost like this layer that can now sit in between all the services we already have and just make them way easier and more interesting to use and more capable than before. But you predominantly still access that through the same computing platforms, right? Smartphones and laptops. So it is very, very exciting time in that way. I'm seeing more and more products that I use every day that are being supercharged by AI, which is really amazing. And I am very blown away by the capabilities of, you know, some of these LLMs and the questions that they can answer in a way that you would never be able to, you know, before with just a Google search, right? I mean, it's pretty impressive. And we'll see, like, in the next 3-4 years, we'll have more and more products that are supercharged with that. And I think the LLMs will get more and more accurate. Right. I think there's still some mistakes they make. They go off the deep end in terms of what they say, and they can't back it up with valid evidence yet. Right. And so there'll be some tuning there, but the breakthrough has happened in that regard, which is really an exciting time. So will we see any brand? I think the question is, will we see any brand new native AI products that mean you now displace the predominant digital apps you use now and start using that instead? I don't see that yet. I think it's certainly possible, but I don't see that yet. I still think you want to message your friend, right? You have to do that through some form of text. Like, you're probably going to do that with text. You're probably going to do that with Messenger or, you know, Instagram or WhatsApp. Could you do that a little bit better now because there is something sort of suggesting you what to write? Yes. Or email, yes, but like, you're still going to get on the computer, get on your app and do it in that way. There are some interesting companies that are now taking what an LLM can do and they're trying to change the interface on top of that. One I'll call out is Humane. They're doing interesting things. Their ex-Apple team, where they're not leaning into AR or VR, but more of like, hey, we don't need, you know, your screen anymore. We can do a lot of the stuff through voice. And that's interesting, but it's TBD on whether or not it can be done that way. But I do think with the existing devices we have now, there is an easier way to have them speak to one another, use voice as input. So I'm looking forward to in the next 2-3 years, the ability to pick up my phone and say, hey, you know, make me a reservation at 8 o'clock at such and such place, the classic example. And now Siri or whatever the agent is can actually understand that, have the hooks into the relevant digital services and apps, speaking to one another well enough where that can actually happen. And that is a new mode of interaction, but it's not nearly as exciting as what spatial XR can do way future down the line. And there is, this is a question you didn't ask, there is an interesting intersection between those two technologies, you know, XR and AI, when those merge, which is already happening in some Unity apps, some amazing agency comes to these applications that you just didn't have before. And that's already happening now, which is cool.
Yeah. I think you've touched on some incredibly, incredibly exciting points that are both happening, like you said, and then will be happening, and probably something that we just can't even think of at this point, which will be incredibly exciting as well.
So cool. It's a good time to be alive in this space, without a doubt.
Absolutely. Well, Barak, this has been a really, really great conversation. And I think we've touched on a whole number of really, really great topics as we've gone through. I have a couple wrap-up questions that, that we'd like to ask everybody as we wrap this up. The first one, and these don't have to be, you know, product or business related, but have you watched or read or listened to anything recently that you've found particularly interesting and would like to share?
You know, as soon as you said it, there was something that popped in my head. If I think more, there might be something that surfaces higher up, but there was a post from Sam Altman, who leads Y Combinator. And he talked about how OpenAI and its invention of ChatGPT went against many of the principles that he and his organization tries to push to all, you know, startups. And then from there, you know, that's a quite influential organization across like how startups think and get to market. And it was interesting because he said, basically, those same principles were not used in creating this, right? It was a lot of, we don't know who the customer is and we don't know what the problem is we're solving, but we threw a ton of money and resources at it and we came up with something that was just really interesting. Then now people are kind of pulling into whatever they do, which is a challenge. It's a very controversial thing to say from someone who's been pushing a different narrative for so many years. There is something about that I don't like, and there's something about that I do like. So the one thing I like about it is I think we've been, over the last 10, 15 years, with all that money that was flowing, a little too like caught up in building things that could drive a ton of revenue, right? But weren't really like game-changing category changes in how we, you know, live our lives. Right. So it was a game of, you know, getting attention, monetizing that. Right. And it's like, here's the next app. Right. And at the end of the day, so much competition in that space. We still use like the same 10 apps mostly. Like there hasn't been a lot of turnover in that. I would have loved to see more products and services. Like when I was 15, thinking about being in year 2023, I would have had a very different view of the future. There may have been some flying cars. There may have been, you know, headsets already that we're using all day long, you know, just really big changes, like internet level changes. And that's what part of what he said that made me think like, you know, if more people think like that, maybe we'll get there, right? Like we're a little more open to that. That's cool. That's kind of what I got into technology in the first place, was those kinds of, you know, mega changes, let's say. What I don't like about it is it kind of, it's like that may not serve the typical startup who needs to also survive in this environment, right? So it's something I'm still processing, but was something that flagged my attention. You know, I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. And I don't know like what, like what direction to take that, because agree completely. Like we get so, and probably going to wax like philosophical here. Like we get so focused on like the business case for everything that if there isn't a way to like make money off of something, then, you know, what is it that we're going to do? Or if there isn't like the need, the apparent need for this, that eventually will translate into being able to turn this into some sort of viable thing, then like, you know, we focus so much on that, as opposed to going almost back to this like childlike mentality of, mm-hmm. I just want to create for the sake of creating and see what comes of this. It may be something amazing. It may be nothing. And to just do that. And eventually, you know, we may get a lot of nothings, but we may get these incredible inventions that are life-changing or society-changing types of things that otherwise we wouldn't get. And I think fostering more of that would be incredible. How we foster that, I don't know. Because, you know,
I don't know either.
Incredible, yeah. It's incredibly difficult.
I would love to see, like, let's have both happen. Maybe that's something for big companies to continue taking on, because they have the budgets to support that, or it's large universities that have those research institutions that can do that stuff. But I want to see more of that happen. If startups could do that, that'd be really cool as well, right? So let's try to back those things that have big ambitions as well. There could be some intersection of those, right? Where they, you know, there are some companies doing that with mobility and, you know, air travel and things like that. That's cool stuff. Right. Let's see that come to market. I'd love that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that's a great call out. Awesome. And I guess the last question, are there any products that you're using or have used that you're either enjoying or maybe not enjoying? Those could be digital products or physical products.
Mm. An easy one is, you know, GPT 4.0. I just upgraded to that, and I was a little mind blown at like how much better it is. I think it's such a capable product that most don't know how capable it is, because they literally don't know what it can do and they don't know how to interact with it. I think it's a really interesting thing. I've never seen that before out of a product. It's usually a product has like a set of affordances and it's clear what you can do with it. But this is, it's just blue ocean. It's like every day I'm like, oh my God, I can do that too. Yep. So that's pretty wild. I've never seen a product like that before. The other quick answer is, I have a Tesla that I think it's just an amazing car. You know, I'm still very bullish on them, and how much better it is than other cars I get into that are more expensive. Sometimes it's leaps and bounds better in so many ways. That's kind of more obvious, but I haven't bought anything more recently that I would call out beyond those two.
Okay. Well, those are good call outs.
Yeah,
definitely. All right. Well, Brog, again, this has been a great conversation. We've covered a ton of ground, but where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about Actuate, about all of the things that you're working on?
Two ways. To get in touch, easiest is my LinkedIn. So not too many people with my name. So Varag Garabjanian, you know, you type that into LinkedIn. Maybe we'll leave it in the show notes. The website is actuatetech.io. So actuatetech.io. So, you know, if you want to get in touch, message me, just go on LinkedIn. If you want to just view what's going on, what we do, then go to the website.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. We'll put both of those links in the show notes so you can check that out. You can get in contact and, chat with Varag about anything tech related, or specifically about, you know, some of the things that may be pertaining to business specifically, if those are, important or top of mind, right now, which for a lot of companies they should be. So, awesome. Well, really appreciate all of your insights, everything that we talked about. I think this has been a great conversation with a ton of helpful information. So appreciate you and appreciate all of the things that we were able to discuss.
Kyle, I appreciate the really inquisitive questions that kind of bring some of this stuff out. So thank you for doing what you do, and keep doing it, please, for everybody else.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And thank you everyone for listening.
Thanks again for listening. If you like the show, be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast app. You can follow the show on TikTok at prodigy.co and on Twitter at prodigyco. You can also follow me on both of those platforms at Kyle Larry Evans. If you want more product conversation, check out my newsletter Prodigy at prodigy.co. You can also follow me on Medium at Kyle Larry Evans, or check out my Medium publication, Prodigy. Of course, you can check out all these links in the show notes.